Welcome back to the second hour of Issues, Etc. We're going to spend the first few minutes talking about this story. Yet more sad news surrounding this drug, the morning after pill. No, I believe it's RU-486, not the morning after pill. It's the abortion pill, we could rightly call it that. We're going to be talking about the deaths of two more women after taking this drug. Dr. Gene Rudd joins us here in just a moment. He's Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical and Dental Association. Then Gretchen Pasentino will be our guest. We're going to spend time talking with her about another story in the paper. He's all about enlightenment. Swamiji, I think that's how we pronounce this, the name of this Hindu leader, spiritual leader. He was here in the St. Louis area teaching people about meditation and enlightenment. We're going to be talking about that visit with Gretchen Pasentino of Answers in Action. Then coming up in the third hour of the program, James Sire is going to join us. We'll talk about the common logical fallacies that are used against Christianity. It'll all sound very familiar to you. He's got some good responses as well. The last half hour is audio open lines. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. We're coming to you live this Tuesday. It is the 21st of March. Dr. Gene Rudd is a regular guest, Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical and Dental Association based in Bristol, Tennessee. Dr. Rudd, welcome back.
Thank you. It's good to be with you.
First of all, do deaths due to RU-486 surprise you at all when you read the stories like this in the paper?
Well, they don't surprise us. In fact, we anticipated such. Nearly 3.5 years ago, we filed a petition with the U.S. government to have the FDA take the RU-486 product off the market because we foresaw safety concerns. When we looked at the approval process of RU-486, we saw that the FDA actually breached its own standards or how it was to go about approving a product. The safety studies that needed to be done were not done, but yet this was railroaded through, in a sense, using a process that was reserved for products that are intended to save life, such as there's no other treatment for AIDS or no other treatment for a particular cancer, and we need to get this product through because people are dying. That's what that process was used for, but they've used that process to get RU-486 approved. And there was not adequate safety standards and studies done at the time. So we petitioned the government 3.5 years ago saying, you know, this is a dangerous drug. We cannot go forward with it. And sadly, that's being borne out today.
Someone's going to say, look, RU-486 is no different than any other powerful drug. All of them come with warning labels, contraindications, warnings that sometimes there can be a resultant death or some very serious side effects. How do you respond to that?
Well, we have to look at the risk and benefits. And first of all, when you're looking at abortion, just say for a moment that abortion is not a moral ethical question, and you're just going to decide whether to have an abortion or not and how you should go about doing it. You have the surgical abortion option, and you have the chemical abortion option, which is using RU-486. And when you look at the profiles, the different risk-benefit profiles of those two treatment options, it clearly falls that the surgical abortion option is better. One, there's a lot less risk now we know associated with it, in terms of dying from the process, but also the experience that the patient goes through is very traumatic over multiple days with a chemical abortion, having to be exposed to the bleeding and cramping and passing of tissue, all which are probably going to have long-term psychological impact on the patient themselves. So there's a lot of reasons to say that a chemical abortion is not the way to go. So why do we have it on the market at all?
How is RU-486 supposed to work?
Well, RU-486 basically blocks the metabolism of progesterone, which is one of the hormones essential for development of early pregnancy. And it essentially is starving the baby of a nutrient. It's not a nutrient, but it, you can think of it that way, that is essential for its development. So it dies. It's the breath and life is taken out of the baby because of this drug. And then 3 days later, another product is given to cause the uterus to contract and expel the embryo. So it's a multi-day process at home. And the sad part about this is because it's outside of medical scrutiny, these complications that are developing are not being recognized to be serious by these young women, and they're coming in too late to be saved.
So how is it most likely that the women, the two latest cases, the women died after using RU-46. Do we know?
We don't know much about the two latest cases, but we know last year there was a cluster of four deaths in the state of California. Now, there's nothing to suggest that this should be geographically confined, and it can't be explained on coincidence. So there is clearly a serious underreporting of complications of RU-46. We know that from doctors who are out there who say, yeah, we know of complications, and, oh, no, they weren't reported. So we think this is just the tip of the iceberg. Other cases are going to be reported as further investigation goes on, and we're going to see a lot of people have had some very serious complications, and maybe more have died than we know. So our concern is that this is dangerous. Women's health is at stake, and while we're waiting on the next scientific panel to meet to review it, we just need to get it off the shelves.
Is the Christian Medical and Dental Association calling for simply that RU-486 be sent back to follow the proper protocols of FDA approval, not this kind of fast track that you mentioned at the beginning of our conversation? Or are you contending at this point that RU-486 is simply too dangerous ever to be approved by the FDA?
I can't say the latter for certainty because there's data's not in. And with lack of data, why go forward? Especially when there's better alternatives for women already. Choice is not a reason to put women at serious risk, especially when they're not well informed about the risk. So our policy, our position is that the drug needs to be pulled off the shelves until adequate safety studies show that it is a safe product that has an adequate or appropriate risk-benefit ratio.
How would this be done? The paper mentions two Senate abortion opponents trying to urge passage of a legislation that would suspend the sales of RU-486 until the Government Accountability Office reviews how the FDA approved the pill. Are there other ways, perhaps through the FDA itself, of getting this pill off the shelves?
Well, there is going to be a scientific panel that's going to meet in about 6 weeks. That's a fairly lengthy delay if you're one of the patients who's taking the drug during that time frame and has a serious complication or dies from it. But in 6 weeks, a scientific panel is going to review this, and they could come back with a recommendation that the drug needs to be pulled off. So it may happen within the confines of the workings of the FDA. Now, it's fairly unprecedented for Congress to step in and say, well, we think the FDA overstepped its bounds, and we're going to pass legislation to force it to do this or that. That's fairly unprecedented. But you have to remember that there was this extreme amount of political pressure put on the FDA to make the decision for approval. And it now may take an extreme amount of political pressure on the FDA to pull it off the shelves until the proper safety research has been done.
Can we, in any sense, look to the European use of RU-486 to get an indication of, to answer some of those questions about its long-term safety, its safety in other respects? I do understand that some European countries have had this thing being sold legally for quite some time. You would think there'd be enough data there to look into it.
Unfortunately, the data is not the best type of data that we need to say for certain. It's not been collected as carefully as research models can be collected, and their surveillance systems are not as good as ours. So I don't think we can take data from another country that is not quality data and apply it to our situation here. We need to do the studies over. We need to do them rightly. And I think that, you know, as my mother used to say, the proof is in the pudding. And sadly, very sadly, we're seeing women now who are dying because there are safety issues with this drug. There's a bacterium that is growing in the wake of taking this drug. That's a very unusual bacterium for it to cause an infection in humans at all. And it causes an infection that at the beginning does not look like a serious infection because the patients don't have a temperature. And they might just think they're having some side effects of the abortion process, or they might think they're having the flu. And the doctors will make the same conclusion while at the same time this bacterium is beginning to overwhelm their system to the point when it's recognized it's too late.
And just if you would explain, the great danger everyone's talked about in the news accounts is sepsis. What is that?
Sepsis is an overwhelming infection. It's when the infection is running throughout the body, throughout the bloodstream.
Why, to kind of come back to where we began, why was RU-486 fast-tracked through FDA approval?
That's a very good question. And I think the only answer is that we have a society, and at that time an administration that was bent on promoting choice over safety. And there was a political initiative that was, and they were very clear about it. They wanted this approved from the Secretary of Health to the White House, and there was a lot of pressure on the FDA to put this on the fast track approval process. Sadly, they broke the rules, and fortunately, there's women now who are paying with the consequences.
Finally, Dr. Rudd, what needs to happen with RU-46?
It needs to be taken off the shelves. It's a dangerous product out there. We don't know enough to say it's safe. The manufacturer says, well, there's been 500,000 users of it now in the last 5 years. Well, that's the denominator of the equation. We don't know the numerator yet. We don't know how many women have had life-threatening or life-ending complications. And until we know that, we're not going to know what the risk benefits are really like. We already know that our surveillance and reporting system, though it's better than just about any place in the world, it's not perfect. And a lot of the complications of drugs, especially new drugs, don't get reported. But then add to that an industry that's cloaked in secrecy, an industry that has an economic motivation to protect itself from scrutiny, to not disclose complications that it's creating. And that industry is notorious. We don't know a lot of the data out of the abortion industry, how many complications in general. And now we're seeing an industry that has vested interest in protecting itself from further scrutiny by not reporting these complications. And it's probably only the complications that result in death that are reaching the level of being reported. And that's grossly in error.
CMDA.org is the website address for the Christian Medical and Dental Association, CMDA.org. Dr. Gene Rudd is a regular guest, Associate Executive Director of the Christian Medical and Dental Association based in Bristol, Tennessee. Dr. Rudd, thanks for being our guest.
You're welcome.
LCMS World Relief is concerned with both body and soul. What does that mean when we talk about a worldwide relief agency with this type of concern? It means extending that touch of mercy, as they call it. It's a touch of mercy that goes beyond simply feeding the hungry, clothing the naked, housing those without homes, reaching out to people across the globe, whether they be refugees, the victims of man-made or natural disasters. It means also the touch of mercy that is the message of the cross of Jesus Christ. It is concerned with both body and soul. LCMS World Relief and LCMS Life Ministries concerned with defending life from beginning to end. We're going to be, they underwrite issues, et cetera, and you can find out more about them at our website, issuesetc.org, issuesetc.org, or you can call and donate. This is their toll-free number, 1-888-930-4438, 1-888-930-4438. Staying on this subject for the next few minutes, recent changes in the abortion laws, and they're changing fast, have been turning the abortion politics and the debate on its head. Here's more from National Public Radio's All Things Considered.
For the past decade, Republicans have been making gains on the issue of abortion. Pressing a series of popular restrictions, Republicans have painted Democrats as extreme protectors of abortion at any point in pregnancy. But with a dozen states now considering bills to ban abortion outright, this year it's the Democrats painting Republicans as the ones whose views on abortion are extreme. NPR's Julie Robner looks at the potential political impact of the changing abortion debate.
In the past month, the politics of abortion have essentially reversed. Now it's Republicans shying away from the issue and Democrats eager to take it on. For example, on ABC's This Week, Senate Majority Leader Bill Frist was asked whether he'd support a ban like the one recently signed by the governor of South Dakota. It includes no exceptions for rape or incest. Frist, who does support abortion in those cases, sought to distance himself.
Again, I'm not going to put myself in that situation. I can tell you what my feelings are, my beliefs are, and my philosophy is about it, and that's how I would vote and vote accordingly. I am pro-life and have a 100% pro-life voting record.
Meanwhile, on CBS's Face the Nation, Illinois Democratic Senator Barack Obama was happy to talk about his position.
I am pro-choice, but I also think that it's important, even as I indicate that I'm pro-choice, to say this is not a trivial issue. And we have to listen to the profound concerns that other people have.
What's going on is no great secret, says Rachel Lazar of Third Way, a group that develops strategies for Democrats to appeal to political moderates. Politicians in both parties, she says, are seeking the political middle that can produce a majority.
Two-thirds of voters identify as abortion grays. They think that abortion should neither always be legal nor always be illegal. And although they lean pro-choice, they're consistently voting Republican.
Lazar says Democrats who want to win back those voters shouldn't be afraid to say they want to see the number of abortions reduced, particularly through better sex education and access to contraception.
There are 1.3 million abortions every year in our country. One in every five pregnancies is ending an abortion, and that's too many. That's certainly too many to the average American. The average American sees abortion as a morally complex issue.
And Lazar says bans like South Dakota's give Democrats a chance to gain back ground they lost in recent years.
The beauty of the message is if progressives define themselves as wanting to reduce the number of abortions in America while protecting personal liberties, they can at the same time define their opponents as being for reducing the number of abortions in America by putting people in jail.
That's exactly what worries Republican Christy Whitman. The former New Jersey governor and EPA administrator now runs a group called It's My Party Too, which seeks to promote centrist Republicans. Whitman agrees that the prospect of more laws like South Dakota's doesn't bode well for Republicans this fall.
People will say, well, if you're a Republican, you've got to be not just pro-life, but you've got to be this hard-edged pro-life that doesn't recognize a woman as being really, once she's pregnant, much more than a vessel. And that has cost us in the past and will cost us.
But others think the new energy around abortion makes it an issue where Republicans can not only maintain but gain ground. New Jersey Republican Congressman Chris Smith co-chairs the Congressional Pro-Life Caucus.
We need to rein in on this killing fields, which has claimed the lives of over 47 million unborn children since 1973, a Holocaust, a baby Holocaust. And as a direct result, I think the pendulum is turning in our favor because people are finally waking up that abortion is violence against children.
As politicians tack towards the center, however, there's a big warning flag for both Republicans and Democrats. When it comes to abortion, the most motivated voters tend to be at the extremes of the debate. Julie Rovner, NPR News, Washington.
All right, there's the piece from National Public Radio. This is a second one, by the way, that we played for you in the course of probably a week, I believe, on how the abortion debate is at least showing signs of shifting. It may not be a permanent shift. Of course, this is an election year, you know, today being one of those days everybody goes to the polls. It is an election year. And that means everybody tacks to the center, including the pro-choice and the abortion advocates. One of the terms I heard there that I had not heard before, abortion grays, those gray areas, or those people, what it refers to that demographic, that person who answers the poll, I'm personally opposed to abortion, but I still think it ought to be legal. Well, now you've got a name for yourself if you're one of those. You're an abortion gray. You're in the gray area. And even the proponents of abortion recognize that as not so much a gray area, but kind of sitting the fence. They know that's where most people are at. Well, I'm personally opposed, but I don't think it ought to be illegal. I call it pro-choice by default. Have you thought about it in those terms? One of the proponents of abortion, they're saying, and those who are advocating for not a softening of the position, but an admission, a concession, that abortion and the number of abortions ought to be reduced, citing the figure of one in five pregnancies ending in abortion? 20%. One in five pregnancies ending in abortion in the United States, 1.3 million a year. That's a lot. And if abortion is only, even if it were just not such a good idea instead of a bad, terrible thing, even if it was just not such a good idea, 1.3 million of them a year is too many. So, you know, there's some sympathy here, at least philosophically, with those who say, okay, come on, abortion isn't a good thing. Let's admit it. I don't know if this political tactic is going to work. I don't know if the abortion proponents can pull this off. First, they have to convince their own rank and file that abortion is a bad thing. Now, maybe that's not such a hard case to make, but then they have to admit, then they have to convince them to admit to it publicly. That's a harder case to make. Now, I got to correct one thing I heard in that story, and that is, the pro-life forces could talk about, we can paint the pro-life forces, as the abortion proponents, as those who want to reduce the number of abortions by putting people in jail. No one's talking about putting anyone in jail. If Roe is overturned, and I imagine this just needs to be said every time we talk about it. If Roe is overturned, abortion does not become illegal nationwide. It just simply becomes the decision of the states as to whether abortion will be illegal, regulated, legal. So no one needs to go to jail if a doctor is just bent upon performing abortions. All he has to do is find a state where it's legal. And if a woman is bent upon having an abortion, all she has to do is find a state where it's legal. And under that scenario, which is the most likely scenario post-Roe, nobody's going to jail. Unless, as a doctor, you insist upon staying in a state where it's illegal and performing abortions. One wonders why you would do that when your quote-unquote patients have access to illegal abortion elsewhere. In a few minutes, we're going to be joined by Gretchen Pasentino. We're going to be talking about a story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch as of Monday, the Everyday section, hanging out with Swamiji. There's a picture of him there. He is a spiritual guru, a Hindu, and it says he's all about enlightenment. We'll find out what that enlightenment looks like and sounds like in a few minutes as Gretchen Pasentino of Answers in Action joins us. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for March, and the days of March are waning away, is a children's book. We talked in the last hour, right here in the midst of the season of Lent, about the Annunciation of our Lord. What is it the angel told Mary this child in her womb would do? His name would be called Jesus. Jesus means Yahweh saves. God saves. Our Issues, Etc. book of the month for March is all about this Jesus and how he saves us. The story opens with the death of Jesus for us sinners, and it tells and beautifully illustrates the story of Christ's resurrection as well. The entire text of this book is nothing more than the narrative of the gospel accounts. It's for your children, your grandchildren, your godchild. To find out more, go to our website, issuesetc.org. Issuesetc.org. You'll find the Issues, Etc. book of the month for March right there on our homepage, issuesetc.org. Or you can call in the 90 minutes left today or any weekday during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040. That's the number for Concordia Publishing House. Ask them for the Issues, Etc. book of the month for March. He is Risen Indeed is the name of the book. 1-800-325-3040. He is Risen Indeed. When we come back, Gretchen Pasentino will be our guest. James Sire will join us a little later in the program, starting in the third hour. We're going to talk with him about the common logical fallacies that are often used against Christians and their arguments in the public square. And then we'll have audio open lines in the last half hour of Issues, Etc.
Defending the faith, teaching the truth. You're listening to Issues, Etc.
We've all heard about the unrest, atrocities, and persecution in the Sudan. Well, LCMS World Relief is on the front lines of providing comfort and hope through several projects. They're helping to provide emergency food for children in southern Sudan, school books and supplies, grinding mills for Sudanese in refugee camps, and enhancements to St. Paul Lutheran Medical Center in Khartoum. Now, for more information on how you can help support relief efforts in the Sudan, look for the LCMS World Relief logo on our homepage, issuesetc.org. Their phone number, 314-996-1683. Late last year, the Republic of Sudan and the Sudan People's Liberation Army reached a peace accord. Many Sudanese who fled their homes will be returning. You can help the resettlement and the education of these refugees by supporting LCMS World Relief. Issuesetc.org or 314-996-1683. LCMS World Relief.
This is Family News in Focus. I'm Bob Dittmer. We all want our kids to read, but are we paying enough attention to what's in the books they bring home? A racy new genre called chick lit is becoming the fastest seller in the publishing industry, and the target audience? girls as young as 12. With slick covers and catchy titles, publishers are luring girls and their parents into buying them. But Steve Jordahl reports the content under the glitzy wrapping is not pretty.
Drug abuse, lesbian kisses, and graphic sex. Sounds like an adult bookstore, but it's actually the plot line of a collection of books for teens called Gossip Girls. They focus on a group of privileged teens whose lives revolve around sex and drug abuse. Michael Craven is with the National Coalition for the Protection of Children and Families.
We've embraced this almost Paris Hilton approach to life. It's all about the here and now. It's all about having fun. It's all about image, and all of the emphasis is on the external rather than the internal.
The author of the Gossip Girl series didn't realize they were that dirty until she was called on to read aloud from one of them at a book signing.
If it took her that long to come to that realization, that's a little frightening.
Unfortunately, the momentary embarrassment hasn't stopped her from continuing the sleazy storyline. Linda Klepacki, with Focus on the Family Action, says the books send a message that's difficult to counter.
It completely negates the message of abstinence, not only sexually, but also from drugs and alcohol and high-risk behaviors across the board. If we put anything that's showing us high-risk behaviors, whether we're a child or an adult, if we put it into our minds enough, we start to slip into emulating that behavior.
She encourages parents to be vigilant. Fortunately, there are alternatives. Focus on the Family's Brio Girls series is a great place to start. For Family News in Focus, I'm Steve Jordahl.
Other titles to be wary of include A-List, Click, and Rainbow Party. For Family News in Focus...
Are the teenagers in your life looking for summer volunteer opportunities? If so, Life Skills is searching for teen volunteers at their summer camp for teens with disabilities. There are 3 St. Louis County locations available, and the camp will run from June 5th through August 11th. If you'd like more information, you can contact opportunities at lifeskills-stl.org. Life Skills, connecting people with disabilities in the community.
Issues Etc. is partially underwritten by Concordia Publishing House, publishers of our Book of the Month for March, He Is Risen Indeed. You can find a description of this picture book on our website, issuesetc.org, or call Concordia Publishing House weekdays during regular business hours, 1-800-325-3040, 1-800-325-3040. Our Issues Etc. Book of the Month for March, titled, He Is Risen Indeed.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Gretchen Pasentino is our guest. You might have seen the story in the St. Louis Post-Dispatch on Monday. Very interesting story from yesterday's paper in the Everyday section. Hanging out with Swamiji. He's all about enlightenment. I was intrigued by the quotes here. I mean, this is just, this is some heady and profound stuff. Whether you believe it or not, accept it or not, like it or not, want it or not, you are deeply connected to existence. Wow. Cool. Existence. Well, apparently he is a Hindu or quasi-Hindu spiritual leader. We're going to be talking about his visit to St. Louis and what sort of spirituality this is. Gretchen Pasentino is our guest. And then, in about 25 minutes, beginning in the third hour of the program, Dr. James Sire joins us. He's authored a new book titled Why Good Arguments Fail. We're going to talk about the common logical fallacies often used against Christians and their arguments in the public square. Audio open lines follows that in the last half hour of the program. The president was asked a very interesting question about whether he believes, what's the big context? Is there a religious context, an apocalyptic context to all the war that the United States is engaged in? He was a little taken aback by this question. We'll get his response and some other audio for you during audio open lines in the last half hour. Gretchen is co-founder of Answers in Action, based in Costa Mesa, a regular guest here on the program. Gretchen, welcome back.
Thank you so much, Todd. We're shivering here in Southern California. It's probably only about 70 degrees here.
Did you say you're what in Southern California?
Shivering at about 70 degrees, 70.
We were out in the Bay Area a couple weeks ago, and we noticed, we actually, on a day that I considered spring-like and shirt-sleeve weather, we saw kids running around in stocking caps and parkas.
Well, you have to understand that Northern California is much colder than here in Southern California.
Oh, yeah, it was all
so
of like...
We're down to 70 here during the middle of the afternoon, and that's pretty cold for us.
Are the lemons surviving?
Well, I think we'll probably all survive just fine.
Gretchen, you saw the story about, I believe it's Swamiji?
Swamiji,
okay. What are we witnessing here? Is just this just yet another bright light of enlightenment visiting us here in the Midwest?
Well, actually, it's interesting. I had actually heard of him before, and what's interesting about that is that there are literally hundreds of spiritual masters in India and traveling from India around the world, giving their meditations and raising money and developing followers to populate and support their ashrams in India. So the fact that I would have heard of him as young as he is was, you know, it's just kind of coincidental, I think. There's really not much that sets him apart from most of the other gurus in India either. Actually, Swamiji is a title for him. Swami means spiritual leader, and a Swamiji is a young spiritual leader. Surprisingly young for his spiritual maturity is what it means. And Paramahamsa is also a spiritual title. That's his middle name, Swamiji Paramahamsa. And that means that he has a particular kind of way he helps you to express the divinity within you, and that is through meditation, as opposed to, for example, you know, a physical yoga or something like that. And then the last name that he goes by, which is Nityananda, is also a spiritual title, and that's one of the major Hindu gods, and it's the god that he patterns himself the most after. So Swamiji Paramahamsa Nityananda is actually, those are all three spiritual titles that say that he is a very young man who can express, help you to express your own divinity through meditation, and he is most like the Hindu god Nityananda. That's a real long thing for his three names. And he was born in 1978, the same year that my oldest daughter was born. And, you know, my daughter, she's not quite 27 years old. I love her very much. She's brilliant, very intelligent, very well educated, went through the whole Concordia system. But I don't think that I would turn to her to find all the mysteries of the universe or the greatest understanding of divine theology that's ever been expressed anywhere. And yet that's what Swamiji is purporting to do. He says that he has experienced the oneness of total existence and total divinity, and it is his mission to help you to experience that too through his meditation series.
Can you explain to me, I mean, first of all, let's just kind of take the Hinduism straight before we discuss whether or not Swamiji offers his American audiences kind of Hinduism watered down or Hinduism cut with something. What is the spiritual thumbnail sketch of Hinduism?
Well, Hinduism is a manufactured religion. It's actually a cobbling together of all of the various tribal religions of the Indian subcontinent under a major umbrella of a kind of a pantheism that the Aryans, that's the Aryans, the Aryans brought into that subcontinent when they conquered it many thousands of years ago. And as part of their attempt to unify the subcontinent, to unify the various tribes under their leadership, they unified all the religions by saying, okay, pantheism can accommodate all the various little tribal religions all through the subcontinent. And that's why you find not only pantheism, or the idea that God is everything, but also polytheism, or the idea that there are many gods that exist. The polytheism in Hinduism is a finite polytheism, that is, the gods are limited. The ultimate divine reality is an impersonal, indiscernible, indescribable, inexpressible, and inexperienceable being or existence of divinity. And that's the underlying basis of Hinduism.
Okay, can you distinguish that? Because some will hear that and say, sounds to me a bit like Buddhism. But I know that there are significant differences between Buddhism and Hinduism.
Well, Buddhism actually developed out of Hinduism. Buddha was a Hindu in the beginning. In fact, Buddhism was not defined as a religion separate from Hinduism for quite a while after the Buddha's life and death. But Buddhism focuses almost entirely on the impersonal, the nothingness, the beingness, the losing your desire, non-goal-oriented, kind of a stagnant existence, while Hinduism is very personalized. Of course, these persons, these gods and goddesses, are limited and they're finite, And your own existence is also a focus. There are goals for individuals. Instead of simply being, you seek to achieve. That's why Swamiji can come to the West and gain so many followers and raise so much funds because he's telling you how to be successful. If you go to the website, the Nityananda Foundation's website, you'll see that it's billed almost as a self-help course. If you learn how to meditate with Swamiji, you will gain success and anything that you want in your own life. That sort of self-interest, that sort of self aggrandizement or self-growth is something that's very foreign to Buddhism but very comfortable in Hinduism.
So as the goal of religions go, although Buddhism has its root in Hinduism, the vector of those two religions couldn't be more opposite, really.
That's correct.
All right. What does it take to qualify as a swami, a spiritual authority in Hinduism?
You know, you could ask every Hindu authority, spiritual leader in India that question, and you would get a slightly different answer if you got any answer at all. But some of the things that are common to them are that at a very early age, their family members and their neighbors notice that there's something spiritually different about them. In Swamiji's case, when he was a small child, he would take clay and mud and soapstone and carve it into idols or figures of the various gods and goddesses and worship them. And that was something that most of the other little kids didn't do. They maybe, played marbles or, played tag or something like that. And he was making idols and worshiping them. He also had an astrologer who came and cast his horoscope shortly after his birth, which is common practice in India. And that astrologer said that he would become a king among the spiritual leaders. Now, there are many children for whom that is said. Not all of them turn into a Swamiji, but that's one of the characteristics. Also, he devoted most of his very early life, in his teens and early 20s, to traveling all around India and learning from other spiritual leaders. He claims that he had an experience during that time of study when he experienced the divine oneness coming into him and on him and becoming a part of that, such that he experienced a brief moment of complete absorption into the all-pervading divine, and then he returned to what seems like a normal human life in order to spread that experience to other people in order to be a spiritual guide for other people. But in the final analysis, what qualifies somebody to be a Hindu spiritual leader is that other people believe he is and follow him, and Swamiji certainly has a following at this point, with 800 centers and tens of thousands of followers all over the world.
What's the role of meditation? You mentioned before that part of his name and kind of the category of spiritual leader in Hinduism into which he falls is a master who can teach you to find enlightenment through meditation. What is this meditation you're talking about?
The meditation is very, very different from what we would consider as Christian meditation. Of course, in the Psalms and in other places in the Bible, we're told to meditate on God's word or to meditate on his promises. And from the biblical perspective, that meditation is a focused concentration on the Spirit of God within you, helping you to understand, experience, and follow the truths that God has revealed in his word. But meditation in a Hindu sense is very different than that, actually, in most Eastern religions, including Buddhism. Meditation in a Hindu sense is not focus. It's not focus on a particular rational content. It certainly isn't focus on a revelation. Instead, it is lack of focus, even though they sometimes use the word focus. It is emptying your mind, not filling your mind. It is having no thought, not having God's thoughts. It is expressing your own divinity, not worshiping the one who alone is divine and who has created you. Swamiji says, I am not here to prove I am God. I am here to prove you are God.
So it is truly seeking the divine within.
Yes. In fact, the meditation program that he promotes is called the Life Bliss Program. In Hindi, it would be Ananda Sparna Program. And Sparana program. And that life bliss program, bliss is the goal. Self-centered human bliss or experience of the divine. Of course, the goal in Christian meditation is to know and love and worship the God who has created us and sustains us. It is not self-fulfilling. It is self-sacrificing in honor and worship of God.
One of the things that that I found interesting in reading the story in the Everyday section of the St. Louis Post-Dispatch from yesterday's paper about Swamiji is the juxtaposition of two things that he says. First of all, he kind of tries to silence any criticism of his teaching by saying all you need to doubt him requires no intelligence. He says all you need is foolishness and a little ego, which we have enough of in this world. So that for those like you and I who doubt his teaching, you know, we're just doing what is easy, what comes easy to us. But then at the same time, he says, whoever meditates in whatever form with whatever mantra is devoted and will receive enlightenment. But that could hardly include the kind of meditation you just described, Gretchen, that would lead Christians to criticize and to disregard the kind of teachings that Swamiji is bringing forth.
Well, you know, it's interesting. He and most other Hindu leaders spend quite a lot of time trying to put a sharp contradiction between the mind and the heart, between logic and experience. And they say if you're going to use logic or science or technology or rational argumentation or to test things or criticize things, then you're never going to find truth. Even though truth is in and of itself, you know, the very definition of truth is that which corresponds to reality. So it kind of has to be rational and it has to be, you know, testable. But anyway, he says, Swamiji and other Eastern or Hindu teachers say instead what you must do is abandon the mind or empty the mind. Forget about thinking, about criticizing, about using rational arguments, about looking for evidence or using the scientific method. Instead, you must only subjectively, relativistically experience. Now, what's interesting about that is that in Christianity, we are allowed to both experience and to test. In fact, we're taught to test our experiences. When Jesus came, he said, I am the Son of God. I am the one who was prophesied in the Old Testament. I am God manifest in the flesh, and not so many words, but that's what he said. But he didn't ask us to believe it just because he said it or just because he was able to gain a following like Swamiji. Instead, he said, test me. Test what I say and what I do and what the prophets have prophesied. And if you don't have an abundance of evidence by which to prove what I'm saying, then you're not supposed to believe me. In John chapter 5, he said, if I come and I testify of myself, my testimony is invalid. Now, that sounds ridiculous for the Son of God to say. How could anything he testifies to be invalid? But what he says is, what he's saying is, if I only had testimony of myself without any corroborating evidence, you shouldn't believe it. And then he goes on to highlight all the different corroborating evidence, the prophets in the Old Testament, John the Baptist, the voice of the Father coming out of heaven at his baptism, the Holy Spirit as a dove, the miracles that he performed, the teachings that he taught in accordance with what God had already revealed, and ultimately his prophesied death, burial, and then his resurrection from the dead with many infallible truths. We believe that Jesus is the Son of God, God manifest in the flesh, the only way to ultimate fulfillment and perfection, not because we merely had a subjective experience, although we do have a subjective experience, but because that experience can be tested and can be proved.
You're listening to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about a recent visit by a Hindu spiritual leader, Swamiji. Gretchen Passantino is our guest. Our call-in number is 505-7850, 1-800-730-2727. Let's talk with Ann, who calls from Crestwood. Hi, Ann.
Hi, good afternoon. I have a sister, Gretchen, who's in something called the Society of Ascension. And their main focus is transcendental meditation and teaching other people how to do it. And Jesus to them is someone that heals them from the inside out, or I don't, her vocabulary is so difficult that it's almost as if we're speaking different languages anymore. I wondered if you were familiar with this, if you'd ever heard of it, or if it sounds like it's
Yes, I am familiar with the Society of Ascension, and it's part of what we would call the Ascended Masters movement.
Okay.
Which is the idea that there are spiritual personalities that have gained spiritual enlightenment and spiritual knowledge that is unavailable to most human beings.
Okay.
And rather than being absorbed into the all divine, they encircle the earth in almost of a physical kind of way, even though they're just spiritual beings. And they interchange all of their spiritual intelligence and knowledge among themselves. And if you practice the proper meditation and you have the proper attitude, you can actually tap into those ascended masters and their lessons, and you can actually learn some of the things that the ascended masters know. Now, that actually is a Western kind of a reinvention of Eastern pantheistic thought or Hindu thought. Okay. It doesn't really have, you can't directly trace its roots back to actual Indian Hinduism. It's more of an American recreation of it or a Western recreation of it. But one of the things that that organization has in common with all of these other organizations is that salvation is a matter of self-effort.
Right.
Whether it's through discipline or meditation or yoga or physical denial or some other kind of a process, you are saving yourself. And the thing that we can share with people that we love who get involved in this kind of a thing is that when did they come to the point where they finally realize that just like everybody else, they are unable to save themselves, they are not left without hope. Instead, when we come to the end of ourselves and realize that we cannot save ourselves, then God comes to us and tells us of his Son who has saved us by his work, and it's not by our own work. I have a sister, too, who's involved in an Eastern religion, and I'm very close to her, and she and I talk frequently. She comes here from India every year, and I always spend time with her. And the thing that I focus on with her over and over again is how much I love her, how much God loves her, and how none of her efforts can in any way bring her closer to God or bring her personal fulfillment, but that when she runs out of herself, that's when Christ steps in and provides everything that she can't provide for herself.
Oh, thank you very much.
And
God bless you, Anne.
Thank you, Anne. Thanks very much for the question. Gretchen, that kind of gets us to, I think, what is the common appeal? People hear or read some of the things that teachers like Swamiji says, and it sounds profound. I mentioned at the beginning, whether you believe it or not, whether you accept it or not, whether you like it or not, want it or not, you are deeply connected to existence. I mean, to me, that sounds like, I guess I am, since I do exist. Although I know he means something different from that. What about this one, if you would explain? When you work with responsibility, your capacity will expand and you will flower and radiate energy. What is that about?
Well, it could be something as blasé as saying if you work hard, you'll get somewhere. Or it could be a more spiritually enhanced kind of a statement saying that if you practice his meditation, if you support his organization, if you come to his spiritual meetings where he does what's called to give darshan or to give you an experience of the divine, you will begin to experience reality the way he experiences reality more and more, and you will begin to experience more and more that you are not yourself a person, but you are merely a drop of the great ocean of divinity, which is all of true existence. The things of this world will begin to fade away, not in a biblical sense, not in the sense of the Bible says that there's a new heavens and a new earth coming, but instead of a denial of matter, a denial of reality kind of way that says that ultimately, the only reality is God. And when you cease to exist as an individual, then you will be absorbed into the divine. That's not quite as an attractive pathway as saying that you can be fulfilled. Ultimately, in Hinduism, your ultimate fulfillment is your ultimate erasing from existence. C.S. Lewis, in his book Beyond Personality, which is part of Mere Christianity, said that most people say that they believe in somebody beyond us, some sort of God, but they mean an impersonal God. And he said, that's not somebody beyond us, that's somebody less than us. He says, in Christianity, we have a personality truly beyond our personality. We have the triune God. And that in that triune God, when we trust him, we don't cease to exist. Instead, we become who we were always created to be. He is the only one who can empower us to be who we were really meant to be, not to cause us to cease to exist.
Finally, Gretchen, with only a minute here, who is Jesus to teachers like Swamiji?
Most of them say that Jesus was merely a good teacher or merely a representation of God for the Western world or the Middle Eastern world. But again, as C.S. Lewis said and other people have said since him, when you look at the words of Jesus, he was either insane, a madman, or he was a liar. He deliberately deceived people, or he was truly who he said he was. The Hindu leaders can't have him be a good teacher when what he taught, that God is personal, that we cannot save ourselves, that our total fulfillment is ultimately by submitting to him, that salvation is by grace alone through faith in Jesus Christ. He can't have taught those things and been a spiritual leader in the Hindu sense. When we test his claims, though, we find he is the true representative of God and the only way to salvation.
What caution would you issue to someone who says, look, I'm just curious about this young Hindu teacher, Swamiji. I want to go hear what he has to say. It seems intriguing, some of the things they wrote about him in the paper.
Most people will go to see something like that, and they will be unaffected, or they will think that it's very strange and not for them. But the real danger is that you will be seduced by a false sense of an ability to save yourself. No matter how much you try, no matter how close you cling to a guru or to a spiritual teaching, if it is not the Jesus Christ of the Bible, you will ultimately fail. In him alone is their true salvation, and it's not by your own efforts or works, but by his work on the cross.
Folks, when you're looking for information on world religions, best place to go, check out Answers in Action, their website. First, go to our website, issuesetc.org. Look on the left-hand side of the homepage. There's a link there just called Links. Click on that, scroll down, and you'll find Gretchen Passantino and Answers in Action. Our website address again, issuesetc.org, or you can contact Answers in Action at area code 949-646-9042, 949-646-9042. Gretchen Passantino is co-founder of Answers in Action in Costa Mesa, California. Gretchen, thanks for being our guest.
Thanks so much. I'll go pick some oranges and drop them in the mail to you.
Well, that would be very sweet of you. Thank you very much.
God bless.
And you as well. When we come back from this break, we've got hour three of Issues Etc. ahead. James Sire is going to join us. He's written some books that, in terms of worldviews, I have found most helpful for about 20 years now. His first one I ever read was called The Universe Next Door. Well, his latest is called Why Good Arguments Often Fail. We're going to be talking with him about the common logical fallacies that are used against Christianity, sometimes logical fallacies used by Christians themselves. And then, in the last half hour of Issues Etc., audio open lines. That means your phone calls, your questions, and your comments. Open lines is always about anything you want to talk about. We'll be playing some audio for you. We'll start out with the president's response to an offbeat question regarding his foreign policy. Does it have something to do with Christian apocalyptic visions? We'll find out what he had to say coming up in 25 minutes on Issues Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Issues Etc. Issues Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is critical for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our address is 85 Founders Lane, St. Louis, Missouri, 63105. You can donate by credit card on our resource line, 1-800-737-0172, 1-800-737-0172. For a free audio copy of this hour of Issues Etc., please visit the audio archive section at KFUO.org. Opinions expressed are not necessarily those of AM850 KFUO. Issues Etc. is a broadcast service of the Lutheran Church, Missouri Synod.